Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast.
We've got lots and lots of things to talk about and to do today.
Covering the territories from the 1940s to the 1990s.
It's the best thing going today.
Interviewing wrestlers, referees, authors, and other media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great.
The cream, yeah. The cream of the crop.
And now, here's your host, Tony Richards.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Special Edition Podcast. We're jumping in here to deliver some extras for you during the holiday season. And alongside here at the Richards Ranch, my good friend Steve Generelli, who has some extra additional info we just wanted to pass along to you for historical purposes.
Yeah, it's really good to be here with you, Tony, and it's great to wrap up the year with you reviewing 1975. And one thing that I found quite interesting, and it's definitely nothing that I really discussed with anybody else, I don't believe, back in July of 1975, as a matter of fact, the tapings they did on the, I think it's the 16th and 17th, or perhaps the 18th, tapings they did in Philly and in Hamburg, PA, saw the debut of the Mongolian Stomper appear on a show there. And I don't have any other listing of him other than that one appearance, which is really bizarre. But
and what was what was the month on that, Steve? In
70? July of 75. It looks like it's right in the middle of the month they did a taping. And
yeah,
I mean, the only thing, and you and I talked about this briefly, the only thing I can imagine is, according to J.J. Dillon's book, he used to manage the Stomper, and he had he always, not unlike a Buddy Landell or some other wrestling characters, he had that self-sabotaging gene in his DNA, and I think he had a fight or flight and just kind of left the promotion almost immediately. And he would have been a good Bruno opponent, I think. He had the size, he definitely looked kind of fearsome looking, and it's a shame that he felt that way. And they never came to the Northeast again, I don't believe.
Yeah, Archie Goldie is the real name of the Mongolian Stomper. He started out in Canada with Stu Hart, and he was one of the top heels of 75, and we were wondering, he would have been a great opponent for Bruno. Why didn't he ever go to the WWF? And turns out Steve found a spot where he did, and that would have been right after he had finished up in Florida, I believe. And he had been in Florida as the Southern Heavyweight Champion. And so then he went, I guess, up there, had gotten a call to go up there. We don't know what the plans for him were, I suppose. But that fills in some mystery, because he's in the top five heels of the whole year.
He's got to be. And I think you said he had some NWA title matches as well.
Oh, yeah. In Florida, he was against Briscoe. And then when that didn't work out, in the WWF, he went to Tennessee, and Ron Fuller's NWA Southern. What's interesting about him is he held both versions of the Southern title in 75. He held the Florida, and he held the Tennessee version. So he was in Tennessee then from late summer up until the first part of November. Then he goes to Texas, and I always wondered why he. Because the promotions were all very cooperative then.
Right.
I don't know. I guess you think there was more tolerance in the South for his temperament, or what do you think? Or just had people he got along with better? Or?
Maybe he felt they didn't expect a lot out of him. Going to New York, you're thinking you're going to wrestle Madison Square Garden. You think all the eyes of the world are on you. I mean, from reading, I went back to J.J. Dillon's book to read that part of the book that was about Stomper. And J.J. basically said, I think this was early 76, right after the time you just mentioned.
Yeah.
They were paired up together, and J.J.'s his manager, and they have lots of plans for him. And Stomper apparently is telling J.J., hey, let's get out of here, or I'm going to get out of here, because they have no plans for me. They have n nothing planned for me. This is just a waste of time. And so he just had that anxiety. I guess JJ said in the book he had, certain issues, mental health issues that made it difficult for him to be happy and stay in one place for a period of time. So that I think that's what happened. I think just the fear and pressure of, oh, wow, you have to, wrestle in front of 20,000 people or go to these cities or people are depending on me. I think it just got to be too much for him.
And for most of 75, his manager was Bearcat Wright. Bearcat Wright managed him in Florida and in Tennessee. When he went to Texas then, that's when JJ hooked up with him. And somewhere in there, and this might be later on in the 70s, Don Carson became his manager. But I don't know. Maybe Bearcat Wright handled him differently, or he was the go-between, and maybe Bearcat Wright was telling him there were plans for him. Maybe he went to the WWWF without a manager, and he started having. I mean, I've told, and you know this, but I have an executive coaching practice, and I work with CEOs and executive teams, and I'm constantly telling them, you have to constantly communicate with people and let them know what's going on, because every human being has a basic need of love and belonging. They want to feel like they're accepted. They want to feel like they're part of something. They want to feel like they're included, and they want to feel like they're significant. And sometimes that need is healthy, and sometimes it's unhealthy. So it might be that the Stomper had a little bit of an unhealthy need for acceptance and significance. Because he had been pushed in some of these other places. And so going into New York, where he might not have been the lead heel, he might have felt like, well, and again, if you don't communicate with people, they're going to fill in the blanks themselves. And 9 times out of 10, those blanks are going to be filled with negativity.
Yeah, it's just the way our minds think, I guess. More more negative than positive.
Yeah, if you don't tell someone they're doing a good job, their assumption is going to be that I guess they don't like me here, or I guess I'm not doing very well. They're not talking to me, So that, especially with, I mean, I've coached creative performing people my entire life, and they can be sometimes a bit of a handful if those needs are not healthy.
Oh, absolutely. And and this is off topic slightly, but I give lots of credit to Bret Hart for he just mentioned it on one of those old WWF roundtable shows that Pat Patterson happened to be on, and the theme of the show, I believe they were talking about the greatest Canadian wrestlers. That was the theme of the show. And Bret remembered what a huge draw that Archie Gouldie was for the Calgary promotion, and somebody that Stu could rely on, and brought him back for different runs. And when Bret mentioned Archie Gouldie, poor Pat Patterson had a, practically, threw up in his chair there. I guess Pat Patterson, even for all of his wrestling genius, he was a bit of a wrestling snob, is the term I like to use.
And different guys are different. I mean, Jerry Oates, who's been on our show many times, he's someone who has an attitude of I just show up and I do my job, and whatever they want me to do, I do it, and I get paid, and I'm happy, and they're happy, and that's the kind of the simplicity of it. But other guys can be complicated at times.
Oh, absolutely. And one other little piece of minutiae I found while discovering Stomper's brief WWWF run was that at the same set of tapings, I'm fighting a cold, Dr. Jerry Graham also reemerged with a Grand Wizard at his side as his manager. And usually Grand Wizard only managed the top talent. I would like to have thought that they may appear in Stomper with him, who knows? But with Dr. Jerry Graham back for another run, I other than him appearing at these two tapings, and he beat Pinky Larson and Lee Wong, who were two of the lowest level job guys that Vince Senior liked to use. He got two wins, and then he was never appeared again as a wrestler. He came back in '85. Vince brought him back and tried to use him as a behind the scenes type guy, but that only lasted very, very briefly. But yeah, it's just kind of funny to even imagine him wrestling in the WWWF in that time frame, because he was, very overweight and over the hill, and he's battling alcoholism. And I mean, I think he was kind of their pet project. Maybe they wanted to give him another chance, but it just wasn't meant to be, because he didn't last beyond this taping.
Well, and some of those older promoters, like Vince McMahon Sr., had loyalty. And Dr. Jerry had been with Eddie Graham. They had been the Golden Grahams, and they had been in New York in 1958. And they had drawn huge crowds at Madison Square Garden and the other WWWF arenas. And the McMahon Sr. had a tendency to stay loyal to those who had done that in the past. And I don't know, talking about psychology, I wouldn't even begin to figure out Dr. Jerry Graham's psychology, but I do know that he was one of those heels that he could just walk out to the ring and make people mad.
Right.
Just his presence in the arena made people mad. I don't understand it. I don't know what the deal there is. All I know is he had one of those auras that was dissonant to people. They just did not like him at all.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right about the loyalty with the promoters. I know John McAdam and I have talked about Bulldog Brower a lot. He's a guy that came in at the end of the 70s, 1979, and had a run against Backlund. And John and I both agreed that he was very past his prime at that point, and we couldn't really figure out, like, why did he come back? But I mean, the one thing you have to keep going back to is, I think Vince McMahon Sr., the elder Vince McMahon, was very loyal to these guys who had drawn big gates with Bruno in the late 60s or early 70s, and wanted to give these guys another chance and at least a good payday or something.
Yeah. Did you ever see Dr. Jerry Graham in a card or anything?
No, I'd have to see a Bulldog Brower wrestle Backlund, actually, but not Dr. Jerry Graham. I think he's got to be one of the most fascinating characters in the history of wrestling. I mean, he's up there with Jim Barnett and some of the other bizarre characters.
Well, Joe Turner and Bill Bowman, they wrestled for a streak in the South as the masked interns. They weren't the original interns, but they wrestled as the interns, and they had wrestled as Joe and Bill Sky and some others. Well, anyway, when they had wrestled as the interns, the promoters put them, the bookers down in Alabama or Tennessee or Georgia or somewhere, they put Dr. Jerry with them. And they said it was the worst stretch of their lives trying to keep up with him and keep him just coming to the matches and showing up. And they were constantly in trouble because of something he did. And to listen to their stories about Dr. Jerry, it's sort of like the most unwanted house guest you could ever want, you know?
That's what I've heard, and I heard he was that most unwanted house guest too. But I know there's you might be having Davey O'Hanlon on a future show,
Yep.
and apparently he had a run-in with Dr. Jerry Graham. I heard him talking about it on another program. He basically said something like, in one promotion, which I'm assuming may have been in New York, Dr. Jerry Graham, like, did something to him in the ring that was completely uncalled for. I think he basically gave him a cheap shot from behind that, was uncalled for. And I think Davey actually gave him a receipt for it in Kansas City when they were both in Kansas City about a dozen years later. So that'll be something you could ask him about.
I sure will, and we're going to have him on as soon as we can. He just had some back procedures not long ago, and he's doing good and he's recovering from it. I just checked in with him a day or two ago, and he
Oh,
is
good.
looking forward to being on the show. So we just want to keep sending our prayers and thoughts to Davey O'Hanlon for his recovery, and I know what back pain is like, and so I'll be happy for him when he starts getting over that. You know, another thing that happened in the WWWF in December that we didn't mention, but it was kind of a significant thing, was on December 15th, 1975, Antonio Inoki wrestled the first time in Madison Square Garden. And he wrestled against a name that many of us have heard, who's a carpenter or an enhancement talent, Frank Monty. And so they had that match, and I don't know why that match was, but I do know that they would be coming back in 76 with the famous Ali and Inoki thing that Vince McMahon was going to be promoting.
Yeah, that's just the beginning. I mean, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because when you think about what happened later, I mean, not just the Inoki Ali Shea Stadium thing, but through the late 70s, is there segueing away from the Bruno era, getting into the Backlund era, the influence of New Japan, the relationship with New Japan. Even Mr. Shima comes in as the figurehead president, and Vince, younger Vince and older Vince, would send all their talent over there, and they'd have these Madison Square Garden series tournaments in Japan, which is just a way of merging our New York talent with their talent and having these big shows in Japan. Very interesting how that all happened. Yeah, Bruno was a big Baba guy and always loyal to Baba and refused to work on the Inoki shows out of loyalty to him. But it's just very interesting. The relationship, like you said, is just beginning here, and it will become very fruitful for those companies in the years to come.
Well, just another little thing about 1975 is you're right about the Baba thing. Inoki had gained NWA membership in 1975. And but the one stipulation was that they could not have a person on the World Championship Committee. They were not going to get to vote on who the world champion was. The other thing was that the WWWF is an NWA member at this time too, which is why they were only calling their championship the WWWF Championship and leaving the world designation out of it, because to be an NWA member, you had to recognize the world champion of the NWA as the actual world champion, which I posted in Facebook, our Facebook Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Facebook group. Come by and join us. We have a great group of people there who post some really interesting things. I posted a Madison Square Garden program with the Bruno, where Bruno won the title in 73 from Stan Stasiak. And in the program, Jack Briscoe has a very, he takes up a third of the right-hand side and is recognized as the NWA world champion on the program where Bruno won the title back. I thought that was interesting.
Very interesting. That's very interesting. You know, those programs which Norman Kaiser and other people were putting together back then, they just had some really interesting factoids and things in there. I mean, I remember even one of the programs I got at the matches, it had like inside, it had ratings, which was more of an After Mag thing or a World Wrestling World thing. But they actually had ratings in the book. It was a top 10. And it said, these are the top 10 wrestlers in the World Wrestling Federation. And the interesting thing was, is that they used people who weren't even in the WWF. I mean, they had, you know, maybe Backlund was number one. But in the list, they had people like Bill Watts. You know, it was like they're trying to acknowledge people in the NWA that they had like a good relationship with. So that was very interesting.
Yeah, right. I'll tell you another thing that caused my head to sort of do a double take, and my head almost spun around. In 1965, Antonio Inoki made his, I don't know what they called it, pilgrimage or whatever, where they would send the Japanese wrestler to tour North America.
Sure.
And Antonio Inoki made his in 1975, and he was in Texas and the Carolinas, and he was listed as Kanji Inoki. Okay. And he was in Nashville, Tennessee.
Wow.
And Antonio Inoki in the Tennessee territory, it just caused my head to do a little wobble, you know.
That's amazing. No, but as you said, I mean, it was a time of cooperation. It was a time where anything was really possible. It really must have been a great time to be a fan. I mean, hadn't discovered wrestling quite yet then, but I was about to, and I know you were too if you hadn't started already.
I was a little interested tyke looking at wrestling. Well, Steve, thank you for shooting me the message about the discovery that you made about the Mongolian Stomper. And I just said, well, shoot, let's just do a special edition
Yeah,
show.
I'm glad you did. And let's keep doing this. Whenever we have some really good news to share or something vital to share, let's do it. And kudos to you on the big show on the Florida promotion with Howard Baum and Donald De Leon. That was one of the best shows I've heard in a long, long time. Very
Thank you.
informative and very interesting.
Thank you. Well, I had very little to do with it other than showing up. Howard had a longtime friendship with Don DeLeon, and he was nervous about coming on the podcast, but he was very excited, and he's been thanking me over and over and over for doing this because after he gave up photography, he just quit watching the wrestling, you know. And But
It's
those
interesting.
years in the 70s were so important to him, and he got to meet, as you heard in the podcast, got to meet so many people and be around so many of the guys.
Well, to his credit, I mean, you never would have guessed that it was his first podcast. He sounded very natural and well composed, and he really did well, good showing for himself as far as discussing his sport of wrestling. And Howard, of course, it was just like sitting in and over eavesdropping a great conversation about wrestling. It was just lovely to do.
And as you and I have said, that's the best. I mean, that's the best when you're just sitting and you're just a couple of friends and having coffee and talking wrestling, and everybody else gets to listen. That's the very best, and that's what we try to do here on the show. And I'm looking forward to our Christmas Super Show that's coming up here in just a few days, and you're going to be back with me on that. And we're going to be recapping Bruno's world title run in 1975 as part of all the great things we have. That's going to be a big, big show. And so if people are looking for wrestling content to fill up their days over the Christmas holiday, we're going to have a lot for them in that show. So
It'll be really good. I can't wait to hear it myself. It should be really good.
We wanted to do this because we didn't want to wait several weeks until your turn came back up to do WWWF. And so that's going to be something we're going to do here. If we have something that kind of needs to come in between, we're just going to do a special short special edition show. So thank you, Steve, for making time for us today.
It's my pleasure, Tony. Yeah, always fun doing this with you, and I look forward to doing it again.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed today's special edition of the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. We got our Christmas Super Show coming up here in just a few days. So long from the Richards Ranch in the Bluegrass State.
Thanks for tuning in to the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast. Tune in for another great episode next week, interviewing wrestlers, referees, and media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great. We'll release a new episode soon. Don't you dare miss it.